Hey there, this is John, and welcome back to another edition of the Mobile Radio Carnival. Today I get to speak to Ben Armitano, an amazing, fantastic LA-based keyboard player. Sorry, pianist. We'll have at it if that's okay with you, sir.
Sure, no problem.
So the name of the show is the Mobile Radio Carnival, and I just tend to let my guest introduce himself, and then I begin to bombard them with questions. So you are up, sir.
All right. My name is Ben Armitano, and I'm a piano player and composer and producer and teacher.
You know, it's funny. One of my questions that I had noted was, are you a keyboardist or a pianist?
Well,
you already answered.
Yeah, you know, to tell you the truth, I consider myself a pianist, but I am a keyboardist because, you know, in gigs and stuff, you need to have different sounds on the keyboard and you have to do all that kind of stuff like that. But I really consider myself a pianist.
Did you start on the piano?
Yeah. And it's funny because I find there are people that are keyboardists and not pianists like that and everything.
Right.
You know? People that haven't grown up playing an actual piano and just started always on a keyboard, when they go to sit at a piano, a real acoustic piano, you can tell they're not a pianist like that, just in the way they touch the piano and the way they play the piano. So, yeah.
I was putting together a thing where I was going to do some jazz. And so I found a keyboard, a pianist. And I expressed to him, he goes, hey, man, the thing I don't want to do is make a bunch of noise, a bunch of incidental noise with my keyboards. And that's what he was talking about. He was saying, I want to play notes and I want it to be a piano, basically, is what he was telling me. I go, well, maybe there'll be a little bit of organ, but for the most part, it's going to be piano, brother. So
yeah.
I kind of get the distinction. Some of you guys, I tried to learn how to play many years ago, but never quite got anywhere near where your level is. You're an exceptional keyboard player.
So, oh, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm excited to talk to a fellow keyboard player, even though I'm not quite one. I switched over to singing. It made it a lot easier for me. So where do you hail from? Where is your home state?
Newington, Connecticut.
I'm
a Connecticut boy.
I took a small tour online. It reminded me a lot of where I come from in Michigan, because you have the same types of trees and things like that. And of course, you've dealt with the winter snow and things of that nature. As a younger person, were you playing rock and roll back there, or did you just start off playing jazz?
Oh, no, definitely rock and roll. I grew up listening to jazz because my father was a jazz musician. So, you know, he played jazz all the time around the house. He played jazz records and, you know, everything like that. So I grew up listening to jazz and everything. And, of course, you know, I started to kind of learn it like that from him and everything and, you know, whatever. So I was studying the art of jazz at an early age, but my first gigs were rock gigs.
Yeah, I thought I saw some pictures of you as a younger dude kind of hanging out with the rock dogs. So I thought that was cool, too. That's something you might have in common with the drummer from Catatonic, from Michael, right? I think his father played jazz as well. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly.
And he talked about, and maybe this is what you're saying as well, like because your father, you were around it when you were younger, that it's kind of a natural step, even though you were playing rock and things of that nature, that it's like all of a sudden you found yourself gravitated to jazz. Is that what happened?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, I love both worlds, though. That's the thing. I mean, it's just like I'm not a jazz snob that kind of, you know,
right,
listens to nothing else but jazz or whatever like that and everything. I love both worlds equally, you know, as much like that. But being around, you know, my father playing jazz and stuff like that and everything, I heard that. And, that's how I learned harmony at such an early age, like, you know, advanced harmony like that, because, you know, he'd be sitting at the piano and he'd be playing all these wild, you know, sharp 11s and flat 13th chords and all that kind of stuff like that. And as you grow up hearing that, that starts to become second nature. All of a sudden, you know, in the beginning, it sounds weird and like, you know, just like that and everything. But the more you hear it, the more it kind of like becomes kind of natural. Like, oh, yeah, that is actually pretty cool. That's not so dissonant, you know, and everything, you know. So I kind of grew up getting used to that kind of sound and that kind of harmony and everything, you know. So but I love the rock. I love the sheer energy of it and everything like that. And, that kind of thing like that, you know.
Yeah, I know. I get it, because when I was taking piano lessons, one of my fascinations, I bought this jazz chord chart book, and all of the diminished chords and how it just felt like I was mutating chords, you know, because that's the only thing I really walked away with of a piano is chorded structure. And I just loved like all of a sudden you could take and you go, well, mathematically it's, they say it's music in the book, but it sounded dissident and it sounded, you know, out there type of thing. So right. I personally get the attraction to it. I noticed too, sometimes when I listen to you play, there feels like there's a bit of a Steely Dan influence.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. I love Steely Dan.
It feels like it sometimes in both just your chorded work where you're pushing the song through, and then also sometimes in the lead, you know, the melody work that you do as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Steely Dan. I mean, to me, you know, as a writer, I loved analyzing their music. I mean, it just like, you know, because to me, every single song had fantastic chords, fantastic melody and everything. And I used to analyze that stuff to death and say like, okay, now why did that sound good? Like, you know, why is he going to that chord as opposed to this chord and everything? And it just became, you know, like a crazy game. I kind of like, you know, I want to tear this stuff apart and really understand what's going on here. Like, and to me, that they were great at bridging that gap because they were using jazz harmony, but they still had that rock rhythm and stuff like that, and so that people could relate to that. And they have very accessible melodies too. Sometimes jazz people, when they use kind of out there jazz chords, their melodies go all over the place and stuff like that. But Steely Dan, that, like I say, their melodies are very singable. Like,
right.
You know, very memorable, very singable.
Yeah, they were a great band. There's no doubt about it. And how they even landed in the rock genre in some ways always fascinates me, because to me it does seem a little more jazz rooted. But what just a great band, except for I think the first album, right, was a little more straight rock and roll out of them, if I remember correctly. Spinning Wheel, I think it was called.
I don't remember what the first ones was, but there was a Can't Buy a Thrill. There was Countdown. Like that and everything. I think they started to go a little more in the jazz direction, maybe around the Royal Scam. Oh, Katie Lied, like that. Yeah. And, you know, yeah. And then Royal Scam, and then Asia, and then they went really. You know, I mean, they used the best jazz studio musicians in the world to you know, complement what kind of style of stuff they were writing. You know.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. One of the coolest bands ever. There's no doubt about that. And it's just, it kind of does make sense because it's your bridge, right? It's rock and roll and jazz.
Right, right.
You know what I'm saying? So you also instruct, though. So you are a music guy through and through, really. When you're not playing, you're teaching.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, I've been teaching for a long time, for over about 45 years, whatever. You know, pretty much, I don't teach like in a university or group lessons or stuff like that. It's pretty one-on-one piano lessons like that. But I started when I first got out of college, like that, probably around 21, where I actually started teaching and everything, and just been teaching all these years.
Well, that's great, man, because it keeps you in the music. I think I told Michael the story as well. One of the guitar players that's nice enough to play some of my music is this German fellow, and his dad was a classical musician, I believe a classical guitarist. And that's what he does as well. He's, you know, can make his living and be a rock star at night and teach during the day type of thing. So it's a very cool thing.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. And it keeps me on my toes too, because sometimes the more advanced students will bring in stuff that they want to learn and everything, and then I'll have to kind of learn it and everything, or kind of like analyze it and everything. And, you know, so some of it keeps me on my toes too, you know, makes me better.
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing, right? Because even though I make the assumption that you're the teacher, so it's natural to think you know more than the student, but sometimes the student may be more advanced than you, yet you still have the skill set to teach them.
Yeah, true, exactly.
Which I find that very curious. I think when I was talking to Rob about it, because I'm fascinated with all of you guys, because first off, you got this really cool band that you play in, Catatonic, and I don't think all of you just stay with that one band. I think you all go out and play different places, different venues with different people as well. But I believe all of you are musical instructors at some level. Is that the case?
Yeah, certainly Mike and Rob too. You know, both of them are very big into it. Myself, I think our bass player, our new bass player, Chris Haller, he's into teaching too and everything like that. I don't think he teaches as much as the rest of us like that, because he's too busy doing gigs. I mean, that guy's working constantly gigs. I mean, it's just so many gigs that that guy is doing. So, but he does teach and everything. And the only one I don't think teaches is Andy, our saxophone player, because he's pretty young right now, and he's
he's right out of the gate.
he
was amazing. We, my wife and I, came up and saw you guys a couple months back, or you're not the last time, but the time before, at the Baked Potato, and we were both really, really happy that we went out and saw you guys, because you sounded fabulous, and you craft music that is certainly jazz, but it's got its own thing. You know, you guys tell your own musical stories. I would like to, before we go much further, put on one of your songs so we can start to show people what it is that you do. And I'd like to start with COVID-19 Blues, if that's okay with you.
Sure.
All right, man. I'm going to put that on.
Okay, great.
That's just a fun one. That's like walking through the blues, right? And I noticed too, you're actually wearing a mask for the video on that one. I don't think I saw you wearing masks in your other videos. So that was a deliberate COVID-19 blues message, I assume.
Well, actually, you know, there is a couple of videos on YouTube that I'm playing with the bassist, Nathan East, the famous session player, Nathan East. And it's an outdoor gig, but I am wearing a mask on that because that was just, I was taking a flight later that day to go back to Connecticut for Christmas.
Right.
And I didn't want to get anybody sick or whatever like that if I had gotten COVID like that, you know, whatever. So I actually am wearing a mask on those particular videos, you know, playing with Nathan East.
Right.
But generally speaking, I'm not wearing masks when I do videos.
Yeah, I got to kick. You know, it's funny. I was like halfway through the video before I even got that. I'm like, wait a minute. Why is he wearing a mask? He's in the room by himself. You were in the room with your magic bass player, I think, on that one, right?
Yeah, exactly. Well, my keyboard piece. Yeah,
he's playing. Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, it was COVID, and I was going stir crazy and everything like that. And at some point, I just, you know, just threw the video on the iPhone, and I just said, let me just play a little blues here like that and everything.
Yeah.
Certainly wasn't anything earth shattering or anything great or whatever, but it was just,
well, I found it good, man. I enjoyed it. And the thing is, so my question is, so is that a sit down and improvise moment, or is that something that you sat in structure? I mean, it is the blues, and it's like I say, it's kind of a walk through the blues. So is that something that my idea of jazz guys is they're so big into improvisation. So was that an improv, or was that something you thought about? And then how do you structure that?
Oh, that was totally improv. That's just a blues. Although I did chord substitutions off of it like that, so it's not a standard 1-4-5-1 blues. So I was doing that, but it certainly wasn't anything structured and everything. It was just me like just winging it and just that's it and everything. But yeah, there are plenty of tunes that I do that I have structured ahead of time. And it depends how complicated the song is. Obviously, if you hear any of my music that's a little more on the complicated side, I've certainly structured it and you know, work things out and that kind of stuff. But for something as simple as a blues, no, I'm just winging it.
You just riff it out. Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to put on something that's definitely a little more structured too. So we're going to get around to that, man, because you definitely have some very cool musical adventures. But I wanted to first talk about when did you end up coming to LA?
1989, I think it was 1989. Yeah, right.
And so you've basically been teaching and gigging around town throughout all that time, I would imagine.
Yeah, yeah, I've been lucky that I haven't really had to get a real quote day job kind of
thing. Nice. Yeah.
I remember when I first got out here, I did telemarketing, which a lot of musicians do and everything. But I hated those hours, you have to be telemarketing thing at 5 a.m. kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I'm not a salesperson. I mean, the last thing I'm good at is calling people cold and trying to sell them, steaks or something like that over the telephone.
Yeah.
So that wasn't good. And I think I got a job working in a supermarket stocking thing. And that was another 4 a.m. situation and everything. So I only lasted that about 3 months. And so what happened was that I was running out of money and I was down to my last few bucks, and I happened to get a gig with a guitar player named Juan Carlos Quintero, great Latin jazz guitarist like that. And at the gig, he said, "Son of all, it sounds great and everything. I got to hire you, more." And I said, "Well, be honest with you." I said, "I think I'm going to be getting on a plane very, very soon because I'm broke like that."
Oh, no. Yeah.
And he goes, "Well," he says, "geez, I'm sorry to hear that." He says, "But," he says, "if you're that desperate for money," he says, "that there's a music store in Palos Verdes called Amuse Music." He said that they might be looking for, instructors like that. He says, "It's a long drive from Glendale." I live in Glendale.
Right.
"A long drive from Glendale." He said, "But if you're that desperate, you might want to look into it." So I said, "Yeah, sure, I definitely will." And I called them, and I went down there for an audition and interview, and I got it. And that saved me, because it's had I not gotten that job teaching at this place of Muse, I was going to be on the airplane going home,
Yeah, it's a rugged town. I know. I came out as an actor, and I ended up working at a actor's showcase pretty quickly on. They invited me to be on staff. And I saw people come in, and they 3-4 weeks later, they go, "Hey, John, it's been nice knowing you." And I go, "What do you mean? Where are you going? I don't get it." And they'd go, "Well, I'm going home, And every artist that comes out here has their limit, is what my experience with people is. It's like you go, "Well, I can do a year and then I don't know what I'm going to do," or "I can do 2 months or whatever." So I can relate to what you're saying, because it really is. It's like, dude, I thought it'd be easier and I took my shot, but I got to go back,
Right. And the thing was, is that everybody in Connecticut, you said to me, "How long are you going to give it?" They all used to say, "How long are you going to give it? A month, 6 months, a year?" And my answer was always, I don't know. I'm not going to put a time limit on it. When I feel that every door has closed on me and there's absolutely no hope like that and everything, then that will be time. But I'm not going to put a set time limit and say, "Okay, after a year, if I haven't reached this level, then I'm going home," like that and everything.
Yeah.
That's the way I would approach it.
It's funny when you were talking about that, I thought, I wonder if you've ever sat down and said, "I'm going to write a song that's 2.5 minutes long." Have I? You know what I'm saying? It's like, it makes sense when you said it. They go, "Well, of course, a musician would be like, I'm going to do the song, man. If it goes to there, I'm going to go to there." You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, a lot, because I write a lot of pop tunes too. If you ever check out my, Reverb Nation and SoundCloud, I've got a ton of out and out pop songs on that, stuff like that. And then, of course, in the pop world, at least it used to be back years ago, it had to be like a 3 minute song. I couldn't get out if it was longer than that. So yeah, I was very aware of time constraints and stuff like that and everything, and making sure I got all my stuff in the 3 minutes.
Yeah.
That kind of stuff.
But you're not now, man. You know what I mean? It's like, it's funny because I want to put Watching the Sunrise up, right? But I did. I had to look at that and I go, "Well, that's a longer piece. So I'll probably end up ending the show with it so I can play it out on that."
Okay.
But I did have to when I do these shows, I do a little bit of that. I'm like, "Okay, how long is it? That one I might have to push that later in the show."
Oh,
but the timing thing is really, because you guys, really do take people on a musical adventure, I feel. So, but let's talk first, before I put on, I want to play Mood Piece as well. And I want to talk a little bit about like where you play with Catatonic and maybe Catatonic before I put on Mood Piece. So okay. That, the I believe the version I have was recorded at the Baked Potato. Right. Do you, I assume you enjoy the hell out of playing at the Baked Potato.
Oh yeah. Playing the Baked Potato is a dream come true. I mean, like, you know, when I was a kid in Connecticut, you know, I used to like listen to hear all about the Baked Potato and everything. And then I used to buy, I think Rob was talking about this on his podcast, how you get bootleg CDs from Japan of performances at the Baked Potato. And I did the same exact thing. I
mean, oh, like, that's crazy.
You know, Rob and I really clicked on a level like the very first rehearsal, because we talked all about that, how he was into that same kind of stuff as I was, like that and everything. So, so I used to do the exact same thing. So I, you know, it was always my dream. Oh God, if I ever went to California, I would love to play the Baked Potato, you know, but because of the sheer legends that play there and everything.
Right.
You know? And there's not a night that goes by when I play at the Baked Potato that I'm not aware of that. And I think about that every time I'm on that little tiny stage. I'm all thinking about the greats that have played that exact same tiny stage. And I get a little nervous, to be honest with you. I mean, you know, it's like, you know, that I'm at the point now where I don't really get too nervous on gigs.
But right.
The Baked Potato is one of the few places that first set, I'm pretty nervous at that first set, like, you know, and the whole band is, because, you know, if you heard some of our rehearsals, we play the music better at rehearsals than we do at the Baked Potato.
Oh, that's funny.
We're a little nervous like that and everything. Then when the second set rolls around, then we've calmed down and everything is good by then. But yeah, and that never leaves my thought. I mean, I'm always thinking about the greats that have played the Baked Potato.
Well, I think that's, personally, I find that very cool, because whenever I do a performance, I do acting as well as singing, and I'm always nervous at the beginning. And I think it just measures how important it is. You know, I want to just be like, hey, I'm cool. It doesn't bother me. But it's cool the way that you describe it, because it reinforces the idea, like it's really important to you guys to play there.
Oh, very. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah, like I used to go there every, when I first came to town, I used to go there every Sunday night, because, you know, a guy named Jeff Picaro was playing there all the time, a drummer, Steve Lukather on guitar. And I used to go every single Sunday night just to see this stuff. So it's kind of ironic that now, like, we've been lately falling into a pattern where we've been playing Sunday nights there. And yeah. I think about how I used to hang out at that club, just watching people like that and everything. And now we're playing there kind of on Sunday nights, you know?
That's so cool too. Cause Michael was talking, the drummer was talking about that as well. He talked about early experiences there, and he didn't do the bootleg copies, but it's such a cool thing. It makes sense. Like why you guys kind of habitate, you know, in the space so well, you know, collectively. It's just, you guys play really, really well together. I think I bored Michael with this. In Detroit, there was this, I don't know, they were like a 7 to 11 piece jazz outfit called Orange Lake Drive, and they did progressive jazz. And dude, I would drag people, friends there, and they're like, hey, what is this stuff, man? I need rock and roll. But it was such an amazing thing. And you guys present jazz that's kind of like storytelling, if that makes sense. What would you consider, how would you catalog Catatonic's music?
Well, you know, it's pretty diverse, which is a good thing. First of all, the guys in that band are very prolific writers. I mean, we write so much music. It's to the point where almost we got to kind of like put a lid on it and say, hey, let's cool it out a little bit and everything, because every single rehearsal, somebody comes in with a new tune. It's like, you know, it's to the point now that's why we made the decision to do nothing but original music, because we had so much original music that in the beginning we were playing covers, like jazz covers.
Yeah.
Everything.
Yeah.
And then as more and more guys kept bringing in original tunes and stuff, you know, next thing you know, all of a sudden we've got 20, 25, 30 original tunes. And then we kind of said, well, why are we playing cover tunes like that and everything when we've got the original stuff? And the original stuff was good. I mean, if it was crap, we'd kind of go like, well, maybe we should stick with the cover tunes.
Right.
But and each guy in the band has their own style, too. So, like, you know, I think that if people weren't to introduce what the name of the song was and who wrote it at the Baked Potato, if you are a fan of Catatonic, you'd know just by the music who wrote the tune. because right. different style. Like Mike's tunes tend to be classic, like real book tunes, like, you know, 32 bars kind of thing like that and everything. There's the tune and then you solo over it. Rob's tunes always have a little quirkiness in them. I like that and everything. He plays some pretty cool, he writes some pretty cool changes and stuff like that. But he'll go off, like, you know, we do a tune of his called 10 Funk, which is a funk tune all the way through to the song till the very end. And all of a sudden he goes from a funk groove, you know, ding, 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 ding. So all of a sudden, bum, 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 a real rock kind of thing like that.
It's right.
Like, where did that come from?
Right.
But that's Rob. I mean, that's Rob's thing like that. And me, I just kind of like try to do different kind of approaches to, like, what I'm kind of tending to try to do lately is write more pieces of music as opposed to songs like that. I don't know if you understand what I'm kind of
saying. I do, actually. I do.
But, you know, and it all depends, because sometimes I'm sitting at the piano and a 32 bar tune comes out, like say Mike, like that.
Right.
I won't screw with that. I'll kind of like, okay, that's the way it's flowing. That's the way it's, you know, going. So that's what it's going to be. It's going to be just a nice, simple 32 bar song. And then other ones, all of a sudden I'll be playing and stuff and I'll get to where the song really should end. And I'll just kind of play around with something else and it starts to go in a different direction. And then I'll go like, well, this might work again and everything, you know. So I start to play around with that and kind of go, okay, well, now this is becoming more of a, less of a song and more of a piece of music like that and everything. And then it kind of goes off in that direction, you know. So, so it goes off. And our bass player, Chris Haller, he's writing now like that and everything. And his tune have a distinct flavor of him. So I think that's great. I love that.
Yeah, you loaded me up with a lot, because when you were talking, I remember, like, first off, I think I describe the music I heard as having a lot of drama, meaning there's some really brilliant changes that you don't expect, yet it still has the motifs and it still works at this purely musical level. And then I see what you're saying too about, like, all the different influences, and jazz allows, and the way you guys play jazz allows for the personal expression, obviously. And so it does, it takes on this whole, like, it's a bit of a travel, you know, through things. And so I do know what you're talking about, where I think also, it sounds like the Baked Potato supports your original work. So they're like, yeah, bring it. We're fine with it. So that's cool too. So you got this space that allows for it.
Right. One of the few places that you can do that.
I mean,
that's the whole thing like that. So we take advantage of it.
Yeah. I think it's really wise.
If we're playing a club that says, hey, you can play a whole night of original music, we're going to do it.
Yeah.
You don't have to cut your arm.
And it's fabulous. And speaking of that, I want to pop on a mood piece for the listeners.
Okay.
All right. Here, we're going to go with that.
Great.
The only person in the world that requests this song. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You actually put it in the set just for her.
Oh,
so if you didn't like it, you know who to go and get after it.
Right.
And it features on bass Chris Haller.
Yeah.
See, that's exactly what I'm talking about. I mean, it starts off, it feels like there's some mystery there. I always use words to describe it because I can't use musical terms. So it's got like some mystery, it travels, it's somewhat whimsical, but it's got this kind of mystical overall planet in the world thing. And it's just that it just travels through different elements of the rhythms that you start off with on the keyboards.
Right. Well, that particular song, that came from those first four chords in the song.
Yeah.
I just happened to stumble on that one night, you know, playing it like that and everything. And I just kind of kept playing those four changes over. And, yeah. And a mood was coming out. That's why I called it mood piece, because a mood was happening.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then I said, okay, well, I like what these chords are doing like that. Now let me write a melody above that and kind of see where that goes and everything. And then that's how that thing, you know, came out. But that's why I did call it mood piece, because to me, it definitely sensed a mood, you know.
Yeah, it did. And that's what it felt a little bit like, around with the chords, the way you right. presented them, you know what I mean? But it didn't at the same time. In fact, it feels, I wrote down that it felt really abstract, but not at the same time. Like, it's very plugged in, it's very grounded, but it was, it, because of the circle of the chord structure that you put in place, it did feel like a bit abstracted at the same time. I used to listen to Adrian Belew back in the day when he was playing around with his kind of avant-garde jazz, and some of it even reminded me of that when I was listening to it, some of the tones and some of the richness of it.
Right. I'm glad that you heard that as a round, because that's a perfect way to, those first four chords going, it is a round. Like that, now, of course, I've got to break away from that because it would get boring as hell if I just stayed on those four chords like that. So that's why, you know, it starts off in a kind of key of C, and then it switches down to a key of A flat. So I get away from that key of C thing like that. But it's always still that bum, bum,
right.
That I think that goes through the entire song like that and everything, you know.
And honestly, it's a little deceiving because it's not, it is obvious now that we talk about it, but it's not obvious in the music. It's not obvious because you know, someone takes well, first off, the dynamics are very, very interesting as well in the piece. But it does, even though there's that circle, it still takes this adventure. So I found it very, very intriguing.
Right. Oh, thank you very much. And it's kind of a piece to feature the bass too. It's rare to get the bass playing the head, and also the first solo of the tune. It goes right into the bass. Yeah. The tune doesn't actually start with any kind of like rhythm from the drums till halfway through it.
Yeah, that was cool too.
You know, like that. And that's a little unusual too. But
yeah, Michael said he needed a chance to go out and get a cigarette or something. So you're like, okay, I'll figure it this way then. You know what I mean?
It gives Michael a chance to play with the bells and the whistles and
exactly
all that kind of stuff and everything. Like,
yeah, that was cool though, to hear the bass. The bass comes in with a part, and then Rob comes in and it's traveling in a different direction, and then the sax comes in. I thought was really interesting, because it's almost like, it certainly was, the sax was a more traditional interplay, but it also was almost like wailing sax held back. Like the riff lines and everything was almost like he could take that and put it into some wailing sax thing, but he didn't. He played it that way, but pulled it back. I found it really a fascinating piece.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Like I say, it definitely is a mood piece and everything. I think of it as colors. Whatever. And that's what the way I approach a lot of writing is like the sonic aspect of it. Like I love to play with like, what is the saxophone and the guitar going to sound like playing the melody at the same time? What is the bass and the saxophone player going to sound like playing the melody? What am I going to sound like playing with the bass? You know what I'm saying? Like
the
sonic aspects of the instruments like that and everything and play. But that comes from my days from learning how to orchestrate and learning how to arrange like that and everything, because, you know, I went to, was a composition major in college. And so I learned that whole thing about how to write for orchestras and that.
Right.
So, of course, with an orchestra, you have every color in the book, you have every instrument to play with, and you know, you understand the thing of what's an oboe going to sound like playing with a flute, and you know, whatever. And of course, catatonic, you know, it's a small five-piece band, but you know, it's I still take the same kind of approach even with that limited instrumentation. You know?
I noticed when we saw you guys live that you guys are all very playful with each other, so that if Rob plays a very interesting thing, it actually puts a smile on your face,
right?
And vice versa with, you know, all the guys throughout the band. And I found that like, wow, these guys really like playing with each other too. Would that happen to be the case? You can confess. You can confess if you don't like anyone right now.
Yeah, no, I can't stand those guys. It's just
exactly
those smiles are all fake.
Yeah,
that we kill each other after the gig. We like get into fist fights.
Yeah,
no, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, it's just well, that comes from listening. Like, you know, it's just like we all hopefully have good ears and listen to each other play like that, because you kind of play off each other. Like if Rob plays a certain lick and everything like that, and I'm listening like that, and I might try to copy it with him like that and everything or whatever, or vice versa. He hears me do something and, you know, play it. Or even our bass player, Chris, is like that. He's another one with great ears that hears things, and he'll adjust on his bass to what he's hearing, you know, going on. And Mike and everything, you know. So, yeah, I mean, that's a big, big thing that we listen to. And, yeah, I mean, it's like a lot of times it's humorous and it's fun and you know, people play a good lick. And, yeah, that's exactly what we want to do.
No. Yeah, I learned
that from Chick Corea too. I mean, like I watch a ton of Chick Corea videos and stuff, and you know, a lot of pianists, you know, play with their head buried down on the piano. They never look up at all. They're, it's like they're playing quote serious jazz like that and everything, you know, and they never look up. And Chick Corea, if you ever watch videos of him, he's always looking at his band members, smiling, laughing, playing. Like his head is hardly ever looks down at the piano. It's the exact opposite. So I kind of try to take that a little approach, like, you know, yeah, maybe be a little more into the performers on stage instead of having my head buried down on the piano. Let me, you know, look and have fun with it, you know?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense to me, especially in jazz, because, you know, I worked at the Dresden and I got to sing with Marty and Lane quite a bit. And that was the first time I'm not really a jazz guy per se, but I got to sing with jazz players and I didn't understand the interplay. I thought Marty, the drummer, was going to set the beat. And that's what I worked off with rock and roll. And all of a sudden, I'm feeling them feeling me, and I'm like going, oh, this is more like actor improv than a structured thing. You know? And I think, too, I was going to ask you a question along that lines, too. So if you, for example, if you write your music in charts, and I assume sometimes you'll write down actual lines because you want to make sure you keep them the same. Does that, if you write with charts, does that mean in effect every time you play the song, it's going to be a bit different, if not a lot different?
Well, if the lines are written, no, those are going to be played the same way every single time. Like that.
Right.
Especially if it's a unison line, like, you know, a lot of some of my tunes, I have myself and Rob play and Andy playing at the same time. So that's unison things that are written out and everything. So that's the same every single time. But then there's other parts in the chart where it's just chord changes. And at that point, those sections of the tune, it's like, you know, you're free to do anything you want and everything, you know, like I've got the basic idea of it like that, or the structure of it, but it's not written in stone. It's like in those sections of the tunes, it's like, yeah, I expect you guys to play, you know, your own chords to it like that, or variations from it, or play with the rhythm, or like the, you know, that kind of thing, you know, like what I'll do is I'll suggest, like, if I write a tune with a bass line, I'll probably write out the first 4 bars or 8 bars of the bass line like that.
Right.
And then I'll say to Chris, okay, this is kind of the thing I had to get the tune started, but now you take and run with that. You go off and do your own thing. And the same thing with Mike on drums. I'll tell him this is the groove I want, like that and everything, and we'll play around with that. And they'll say, okay, then after we've done that, now you kind of play around with it and do your own thing, you know. So,
well, I understand too that you guys are going to trust each other at this point because you've been playing together for a while. But for example, the bass lead, if it would be called that in Mood Piece, how much of that is kind of scripted for the bass player, and how much latitude? And if you don't want to talk about that particular piece, I'm just trying to see how, you know, easy you are with controlling your music, really, is the idea of, like, you know, I want to hear it this way. Because I'm sure you're surprised a lot of times, too, when you give latitude. You're like, oh, damn, that sounds really good. I wouldn't have thought of that.
Yeah. In that particular tune, the melody is written out for everybody to play. But then right as soon as the first part of the tune is done and goes into that bass solo, okay, that's Chris on his own, completely do your own thing like that. And then consequently all the other solos, Rob's solo, Andy's solo, like that, that's all you guys do whatever you want and everything like that, you know. And then when the melody comes back, then that's written out and you're supposed to play the melody. And a lot of times I've written harmony too, so in other words, Andy will play, like, say the lead part of it, and Rob will play a harmony to that. So in case you got to play the right things like that, or else it's not going to mash up like that and everything. So if one guy is taking his own interpretation of the rhythm and the other guy is doing the same thing, then it's not going to match, because all of a sudden, like, you know, that harmony's not there anymore, and it's now a potential train wreck can happen like that and everything, you know. But
I noticed the fact that you had a guitar player and your sax player playing the same lines basically, and I thought, damn, that's amazing that they can improvise that way. I thought they were so in tune to each other that they were actually doing the Zen improvisation. but you clarified that with it. A lot of times you'll write that out for them.
Yeah. And I love the sound of a guitar and sax playing together like that. I love that sonic sound of that. I really love that.
Well, plus then, like you say, sometimes you'll end up playing the same line too. And then it's like this wall of sound type of musical psychology, basically.
Yeah, the Phil Spector Wallace.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty damn cool. You know what I mean? It really is.
Exactly.
You know what? I want to kind of, I can't remember. There was a song that you have on your channel that I believe you use a harpsichord sound on. Do you remember that song, that piece? It's a really simple piece. Not off the top of your head, huh? That's the problem because you.
Yeah, I remember doing something with a harpsichord sound.
Yeah, I wish I remembered the name of that one, but because it was really interesting the way that because I see you, I saw you. This is the way I pegged you as a guy who plays the piano, and then you can obviously play any other keyboard, but because of the way that you structure your vibe, it's just like, yeah, he definitely started on a piano. And then from time to time, I'll see you play around with different audio textures. And I found it really fascinating. I was going to use the song to make this point, but, and then I thought, no, I wouldn't, but it's really cool because it's a harpsichord, feel, but it also felt you played it like a guitar. And it had it had this beautiful mix of the way you played it because of its audio sound. You know what I mean? It, like you're responding to the sound itself. It's and that's what helps create the song. Gibberish makes any sense at all.
Yeah.
But I find it really fascinating.
Yeah. And you have to think differently as a player too, because if I'm using like, say, a harpsichord or a guitar patch on a keyboard,
right.
I got to think about how does a guitar player actually play this song as opposed to how I would on the piano. So it makes me think differently like that and everything. I approach, there's a pop tune that I have on I think Reverb Nation. I think it's called Far Away From Home, where mm-hmm. I have a guitar, acoustic guitar patch on it the entire way through. And people think that that's an acoustic guitar player playing like that and everything. And I purposely played the tune like I thought an acoustic guitar player would play because I wanted people to think it was an acoustic guitar, not a piano at all.
Yeah.
And I think it's successful. I think most people do think it's actually a guitar, an acoustic guitar rather than a piano.
Well, I think it's successful because you have the sensitivity, the musical sensitivity to do it because it's such an intentional thing to make what I experience. I'm like, well, oh, that's a harpsichord. And it's like, oh my God, it sounds more like a guitar, to exactly your point. And I also noticed like your technique is so simple for you. I mean, you can, I think what movie was it where Gladiator, where he's asked to make it look harder than he is, harder than it is. You know what I mean? I think you need to do that sometimes. I'm like, damn, look how easy this is for this guy.
Well, believe me, it's a lot of hard work. It's,
yeah.
Believe me, I'm sweating my ass off when it's making it look easy like that. And I'm always constantly thinking, you know, man, I better not screw up. I better, you know, go for the right notes and everything, you know. But yeah, that's just a product of practicing a lot and everything,
yeah.
and just trying to do it as good as I can. And you know, like I say, that whole thing from the acoustic piano, it's like, you know, I used to play at the Regent Beverly Wilshire Hotel when I first moved to LA. That was one of the first steady gigs I had. And I played on a beautiful baby grand piano there every night. And of course, you know, I thought I was playing better just simply because the piano was so beautiful. And so
yeah, it sounded better.
Of course I didn't. I played the same crap that I always play anywhere on anything like that.
That's funny.
Just in my mind, I'm just thinking, you know, yeah, I'm sounding really great here, man, like that and everything, you know, just because of the nature of the instrument, you know. So and that's important, too, because that's where, like, you know, classical pianists have over jazz pianists, or some jazz pianists, whatever. But the touch of the instrument, I mean, they know how to, like, you know, milk that thing quiet so at certain points, make it roar at certain other points like that. And that's the kind of thing that you have to play on an acoustic piano to develop that. You know, you can't grow up playing an electric keyboard and learn that touch, you know.
Well, I always found, again, I didn't travel very far with a piano. I spent, I don't know, 12 years with it, and I didn't really get very far. But one of the things I found fascinating about a piano, and I think this is to your point, is just how you hold a sustain can be, like, you could probably give a master class on that, because the truth is, you're right. If you learn on an electric keyboard, it's a completely different thing than all of the tone and how long do you hold, you know. You hit a chord and you go on a melody, how long do you hold that sustain is an art in itself. And that's the stuff that I noticed when you played, that you had mastered so many things that I could just only look and go, damn, I wish I could do that. Well, so you know, it's cool to see a guy do what you're doing is what I'm rambling about, man.
Well, thank you. The sustain pedal, yeah, that's a very important part of piano playing that people don't understand. And it's like, it's really funny because sometimes when I'm doing a session and say it's a drummer that has a keyboard at his studio, he'll say to me, you know, you don't have to bother bringing a keyboard. I've got one here like that. And sometimes I've shown up at the session and yeah, the guy's got a keyboard, but there's no sustain pedal.
Right.
And I'll kind of go like, well, you know, this is not going to sound very good if you don't have a sustain pedal, because they don't know enough to have a sustain
right.
pedal. No, a drummer that doesn't really play piano just buys a keyboard. He doesn't think about what a sustain pedal is and what that does or whatever. So consequently, what I've done now is now when I ever get called for a session, they say, I've got a keyboard here. I bring my own sustain pedal.
Yeah.
Just to be on the safe side to make sure like that. And you know, I remember playing, you know, one time there was a club in San Pedro called, I think, the Whale and Ale or something like that. And the guy had a nice baby grand piano in there, but the sustain pedals weren't working. So
right.
After the first measure of the first song, like the sustain pedal was like, you know, it wasn't working. So it's like, oh my God, this is going to be a long, horrible night and everything. And so, of course, it sounds terrible. So after the first set, the club owner comes over to me and he goes, hey, man, you sound great. You sound great. He says, what do you think of that piano? And I says, well, the piano's nice. I says, but do you realize that the sustain pedal's broken on this thing? And he goes, oh, no, I didn't realize that. I says, yeah, you really ought to get that fixed. I said, that's an important thing of the piano. Oh, yeah, I'll get that fixed. So anyway, I played there again like 3 months later, and he never fixed it. It was the same thing, you know. So
yeah, because he doesn't get it, man. Especially, I don't know, especially I assume playing some of the jazz chords that you put in, you really would want to put that sustain pedal to use.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It rings the chords out and everything. And,
yeah.
Yeah, it's an incredibly important part of the instrument.
Yeah. But I mean, I'll compliment you yet again. You definitely have it down, and you have the same quality as your fellow musicians in Catatonic. You guys all make it look super easy, which I understand that's a lot of work to get there, but it's really cool to see.
Well, it's all smoke and mirrors.
Yeah, no, it's all those fingers going to town on all you guys. Hey, so what's your, like, do you got a favorite story of bumping into maybe an icon? I think I remember reading somewhere or seeing you say Keith Emerson was one of your keyboard. Am I wrong about this?
Oh, no, totally. Yeah, totally. Keith Emerson. Yeah, that's why I say, I mean, I'm a jazz guy like that and everything. But, you know, I love that whole rock and roll thing. I love rock and everything. I mean, you know, that Keith Emerson was my eye. Keith Emerson to me made it cool to be a keyboard player.
Yeah, he was pretty cool, that twirling keyboard in the sky.
Yeah, because, you know, back then, I mean, the guitar player was always the hero and everything. That was the guy that, did. You know, I remember in the early rock bands I played, and all I did was like hold chords. You know, I just had an organ patch and I would just hold chords the entire time. But then when Keith Emerson came along, you know, he was the lead instrument. Like, you know, it was keyboard, bass, and drums. And all of a sudden, I understood what a keyboard player could do in a band, especially as great as Keith was. So so the way I met him was that my uncle used to sell vintage drums to famous rock stars and everything. You know, I had my uncle Charlie Donnelly. And he sold drums to Carl Palmer of Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
Right.
So I got to go backstage and everything, and I got to meet Keith, and I was like, you know, Jack, I was like, I couldn't speak in the whole nine yards.
Of course.
And so I was just like, you know, oh my God, I worship you. You know, thank you so much for, you know, making me want to be a keyboard player and stuff. And he was just so great. I mean, that's the thing too. And so humble guy, sweet, sweet man. Like that was just like, you know, absolutely wonderful. And then I was lucky to meet him a few times at the NAMM show after that, like that. So I actually met him several times after that and everything. And what was really cool was that one night at the Baked Potato, his fiance, Mari, came to see us like that and everything. I started to become a little bit of friends with her on Facebook. So
right.
She had texted me and she said, hey, I see you're playing the Baked Potato. She goes, I live, you know, just a couple of blocks away from there. I'd like to come and see you play. So she did. And that was the highest compliment I could ever get was that she said to me, she goes, Keith would have loved the way you play. Like,
nice.
I was like, oh, thank you, God. I mean, that's just too kind and everything like that. But oh my God, you know, just whatever. So, I mean, that was just amazing, you know.
That's pretty cool, man. I mean, Keith was obviously amazing. It was a three piece and one was a keyboard player. And, you know, you're like, I think Carl would switch from bass to guitar on some of the songs and it still felt like a whole orchestra of music coming at you. It was an amazing group.
Right, exactly, you know. And it's funny, too, because I was thinking when Mari came, you know, of course, Keith, you know, had died, you know, a few years earlier. But if he was still alive and they had both had come to see me at the Baked Potato, I would have, like, you know, if Keith Emerson walked into the Baked Potato and someone was watching me play, I'd be like, God, forget it, I'm leaving.
Exactly. Like, your fingers would freeze, man. Yeah, you're just like, I'm done. Hey, Keith, you want to sit in, man? Because I can't play anything right now. I'm sorry. I'm having a moment.
Exactly.
What about, like, because you play the Baked Potatoes, a lot of the Wrecking Crew guys used to hang out there. What about, like Leon or, you know, some of those cats on keyboard?
Oh, Leon Russell?
Yeah.
Yeah. He was a great player too. Like, you know, now see, he had a style that hard to describe what it was, but it's kind of like a swampy kind of New Orleans kind
It
of.
was, wasn't it?
You know, it's like it was him. It was definitely him, like that, and everything. And that's not a style that I think I played very well. Although a brand new tune that Catatonic's doing of mine is called "Draining the Swamp,"
Oh,
which I
interesting.
that's just we did it for the first time at the last time we played the Baked Potato, and that was a real New Orleans like a second line kind of thing like that.
Yeah.
And that was a lot of fun. I mean, the crowd really got into it and everything. And in fact, Mike's girlfriend is from New Orleans. And she said, like, she gave me a big compliment. She goes, "We were getting ready to get up and do a second line dance to that tune, man. Like it sounded like authentic New
Yeah.
Orleans." And that was because that's exactly what I was going for. So, I mean, that was like great that, you know, that thing. But yeah, I'm not, you know, I wish I could play like him. I wish I could play like Dr. John is
Yeah,
another.
those guys got that, like you say, New Orleans thing, or even a little bit of a Delta blues vibe in it.
Right, exactly. But
Well,
yeah, it was.
I like the way you play. I wouldn't hold anything against you. You don't have to play like those guys.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that very, very much. I appreciate
Yeah.
that very much.
Well, I appreciate you talking with me. I'd like if you would to let my audience know where they can get a hold of you. You can pitch like whatever you want to pitch, and then we'll come back from that a little bit, and I'll introduce Watching the Sunrise, and we'll go out with that.
Okay, before I do that, I just want to tell you that thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed doing this and everything. And if we ever do it again, maybe I can play a little while we're talking.
Oh, that'd be great. You know what's interesting? The reason I really wanted, I'm so glad you did this, is because I ended up doing you guys and the other two guys in the band. I didn't get everyone in the band, but you're going to all be in the same kind of section. It goes
Oh,
from
great.
if the people that listen to the podcast will get you and then Michael and then Rob, and I just thought that'd be pretty neat to top it off with the three of you guys.
Yeah, but I could like perhaps to demonstrate like on Mood Piso's chords, I could
That'd
like
be great. I'll
kind
do it. Yeah. I'll get back with you and we can do that.
But yeah, as far as finding me goes, I don't have a website. I've got to get on making a website, but best way is probably through Facebook, Ben Armentano on Facebook. On Instagram, I think my thing is Piano and Songs 88 on Instagram. But of course, you can put Ben Armentano on that. I have Reverb Nation. I have SoundCloud. Let's see, Instagram.
YouTube too. I think I caught a
Oh,
lot of your stuff on YouTube.
yeah. YouTube is probably the best, right? Because I have
Yeah.
ton of videos on YouTube, and for some reason on YouTube my channel has split into two. For some reason I have no idea why that happened, but I don't know why I have two YouTube channels like that. I mean, I'm trying to find out how to get the songs from the first YouTube channel all onto the second one, but I can't seem to do it. So anyway, there's two channels on
That's
YouTube.
kind of crazy, man. You lost all control of YouTube, man. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
Well, I mean, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll travel out with your lovely song, Watching the Sunrise.
Thank you, John. I appreciate it.
Thank you, man.
Thank you.